of rats, each bite of which seemed to infect him with a creeping poison. At last he crawled out from under Sephira's wing, taking care not to wake her, and wandered back to his tent. As before, the Nighthawks rose when they saw him. Their commander, a thick-set man with a crooked nose, came forward to meet Aragorn. "Is there anything you need, Shadeslayer?" he asked. Aragorn dimly remembered that the man's name was Garvan, and something Nasawada had told him about the man losing his senses after examining the minds of the elves. The man appeared well enough now, although his gaze had a certain dreamy quality. Still, Aragorn assumed Garvan was capable of carrying out his duties, otherwise Jormungandr would never have allowed him to return to his post. "Not at the moment, Captain," Aragorn said, keeping his voice low. He took another step forward, then paused. "How many of the Nighthawks were killed tonight?"
"Six, sir. An entire watch. We'll be short-handed for a few days until we can find suitable replacements. And we'll need more recruits in addition to that. We want to double the force around you."
A look of anguish perturbed Garvan's otherwise distant gaze.
"We failed her, Shadeslayer. If there had been more of us there, maybe..."
"We all failed her," said Aragorn. "And if there had been more of you there, more of you would have died." The man hesitated, then nodded, his expression miserable.
"I failed her," thought Aragorn, as he ducked into his tent.
Nasawada was his liege lord. It was his duty to protect her, even more than it was that of the Nighthawks. And yet the one time she had needed his help, he had been unable to save her. He cursed once, viciously, to himself. As her vassal, he ought to be searching for a way to rescue her, to the exclusion of all else. But he also knew that she would not want him to abandon the Varden just for her sake. She would rather suffer and die than allow her absence to harm the cause to which she had devoted her life. Aragorn cursed again, and began to pace back and forth within the confines of the tent.
"I'm the leader of the Varden."
Only now that she was gone, did Aragorn realize that Nasawada had become more than just his liege lord and commander. She had become his friend, and he felt the same urge to protect her that he often felt with Arya. If he tried, however, he could end up costing the Varden the war.
"I'm the leader of the Varden."
He thought of all the people who were now his responsibility, Roran and Katrina and the rest of the villagers from Carverhall, the hundreds of warriors whom he had fought alongside, and many more as well, the dwarves, the weircats, and even the Urgles. All now under his command, and dependent on him to make the right decisions in order to defeat Galbatorix and the Empire. Aragorn's pulse surged, causing his vision to flicker. He stopped pacing and clutched at the pole in the center of the tent, then dabbed the sweat from his brow and upper lip. He wished he had someone to talk to. He considered waking Sephira, but discounted the idea. Her rest was more important than listening to him complain. Nor did he want to burden Arya or Gleda with problems they could do nothing to solve. In any event, he doubted he would find a sympathetic listener in Gleda when their last exchange had been so barbed. Aragorn resumed his monotonous circuit. 3 steps forward, turn, 3 steps back, turn, and repeat. He had lost the belt of Beloth the Wise, he had allowed Murtagh and Thorn to capture Nasawada, and now he was in charge of the Varden. Again and again, the same few thoughts kept running through his mind, and with each repetition, his sense of anxiety increased. He felt as if he were caught in a maze without end, and round every unseen corner lurked monsters waiting to pounce. Despite what he had said during the meeting with Oryk, Orin, and the others, he could not see how he, the Varden, or their allies, could defeat Galbatorix. "I wouldn't even be able to rescue Nasawada, assuming I had the freedom to chase after her and try." Bitterness welled up inside him. The task before them seemed hopeless. "Why did this have to fall to us?" He swore and bit the inside of his mouth until he could not bear the pain. He stopped pacing and crumpled to the ground, wrapping his hands around the back of his neck.
"It can't be done, it can't be done," he whispered, rocking from side to side upon his knees. "It can't."
In his despair,
Aragorn thought of praying to the dwarf god Gunterra for help, even as he had done before. To lay his troubles at the feet of one greater than himself, and to trust his fate to that power, would be a relief. Doing so would allow him to accept his fate, as well as the fates of those he loved, with greater equanimity, for he would no longer be directly responsible for whatever happened. But Aragorn could not bring himself to utter the prayer. He was responsible for their fates, whether he liked it or not, and he felt it would be wrong to pass off his responsibility to anyone else, even a god, or the idea of a god. The problem was, he did not think he could do what needed to be done. He could command the Varden, of that he was reasonably sure. But as for how he might go about capturing Urabain and killing Galbatorix, there he was at a loss. He did not have the strength to go up against Murtagh, much less the king, and it seemed unlikely in the extreme that he could think of a way around either of their wards. Capturing their mines, or at least Galbatorix's, seemed equally improbable. Aragorn dug his fingers into the nape of his neck, stretching and scratching his skin as he frantically considered every possibility, no matter how unlikely. Then he thought of the advice Solombum had given him in Tirm so long ago. The Weircat had said,
"Listen closely, and I will tell you two things. When the time comes and you need a weapon, look under the roots of the Manoa tree. Then, when all seems lost and your power is insufficient, go to the Rock of Cuthien and speak your name to open the Vault of Souls."
His words concerning the Manoa tree had proven true. Under it, Aragorn had found the bright steel he needed for the blade of his sword. Now a desperate hope flared inside Aragorn as he pondered the second of the Weircat's pronouncements. "If ever my power was insufficient, and if ever all seemed lost, it is now," thought Aragorn. However, he still had no idea where or what the Rock of Cuthien or the Vault of Souls were. He had asked both Aramis and Arya at different times, but they had never returned an answer. Aragorn reached out with his mind then, and searched through the camp, until he found the distinctive feel of the Weircat's mind.
"Solombum," he said, "I need your help. Please come to my tent."
After a moment, he felt a grudging acknowledgement from the Weircat, and he severed the contact. Then Aragorn sat alone in the dark, and waited. Fragments, half-seen and indistinct. Over a quarter of an hour passed before the flap to Aragorn's tent stirred, and Solombum pushed his way inside, his padded feet nearly silent upon the ground. The tawny Weircat walked past Aragorn without looking at him, jumped onto his cot and settled among his blankets, whereupon he began to lick the webbing between the claws of his right paw. Still not looking at Aragorn, he said,
"I am not a dog to come and go at your summons, Aragorn."
"I never thought you were," Aragorn replied, "but I have need of you, and it is urgent." The rasping of Solombum's tongue grew louder as he concentrated on the leathery palm of his foot.
"Speak then, Shadeslayer. What do you want?"
"One moment." Aragorn stood and went over to the pole where his lantern hung. "I'm going to light this," he warned Solombum. Then Aragorn spoke a word in the ancient language, and a flame sprang to life atop the wick of the lantern, filling the tent with a warm, flickering illumination. Both Aragorn and Solombum squinted while they waited for their eyes to adjust to the increase in brightness. When the light no longer felt quite so uncomfortable, Aragorn seated himself on his stool, not far from the cot. The Weircat, he was puzzled to see, was watching him with ice-blue eyes. "Weren't your eyes a different color?" he asked. Solombum blinked once, and his eyes changed from blue to gold. Then he resumed cleaning his paw.
"What do you want, Shadeslayer? The night is for the doing of things, not sitting and talking."
The tip of his tasseled tail lashed from side to side. Aragorn wet his lips, his hope making him nervous. "Solombum, you told me that when all seemed lost, and my power was insufficient. I should go to the Rock of Kuthien and open the Vault of Souls. The weercat paused in his licking.
Ah, that.
Yes, that. And I need to know what you meant by it. If there's anything that can help us against Galbatorix, I need to know about it now. Not later. Not once I manage to solve one riddle or another, but now. So where can I find the Rock of Kuthien? How do I open the Vault of Souls? And what will I find inside it? Solemn Bum's black-tipped ears angled backward slightly, and the claws on the paw he was cleaning extended halfway from their sheaths.
I don't know.
You don't know? Exclaimed Aragorn in disbelief.
Must you repeat everything I say?
How can you not know?
I don't know.
Leaning forward, Aragorn grabbed Solemn Bum's large, heavy paw. The weercat's ears flattened, and he hissed and curled his paw inward, digging his claws into Aragorn's hand. Aragorn smiled tightly and ignored the pain. The weercat was stronger than he had expected, almost strong enough to pull him off the stool. No more riddles, Aragorn said. I need the truth, Solemn Bum. Where did you get this information, and what does it mean? The fur along Solemn Bum's spine bristled.
Sometimes riddles are the truth, you thick-headed human. Now let me go, or I'll tear your face off and feed your guts to the crows.
Aragorn maintained his grip for a moment longer. Then he released Solemn Bum's paw and leaned back. He clenched his hand to help dull the pain and stop the bleeding. Solemn Bum glared at him with slitted eyes, all pretense of detachment gone.
I said I don't know, because despite what you might think, I do not know. I have no knowledge of where the Rock of Kuthien might lie, nor how you might open the Vault of Souls, nor what the vault might contain.
Say that in the ancient language. Solemn Bum's eyes narrowed even farther, but he repeated himself in the tongue of the elves, and then Aragorn knew he was speaking the truth. So many questions occurred to Aragorn, he hardly knew which to ask first. How did you learn of the Rock of Kuthien, then? Again Solemn Bum's tail lashed from side to side, flattening wrinkles in the blanket.
For the last time, I do not know, nor do any of my kind.
Then how? Aragorn trailed off, overcome by confusion.
Soon after the fall of the Riders, a certain conviction came upon the members of our race that should we encounter a new rider, one who was not beholden to Galbatorix, we should tell him or her what I told you, of the Manoa tree and of the Rock of Kuthien.
But where did the information come from? Solemn Bum's muzzle wrinkled as he bared his teeth in an unpleasant smile.
That we cannot say. Only that whoever or whatever was responsible for it meant well.
How can you know that? Exclaimed Aragorn. What if it was Galbatorix? He could be trying to trick you. He could be trying to trick Saphira and me so as to capture us.
No,
said Solemn Bum, and his claws sank into the blanket under him.
Weercats are not so easily fooled as others. Galbatorix is not the one behind this. Of that I am sure. Whoever wanted you to have this information is the same person or creature who arranged for you to find the bright steel for your sword. Would Galbatorix have done that?
Aragorn frowned. Haven't you tried to find out who is behind this?
We have.
And?
We failed.
The weercat ruffled his fur.
There are two possibilities. One, that our memories were altered against our will, and we are the pawns of some nefarious entity. Or two, that we agreed to the alteration for whatever reason. Perhaps we even excised the memories ourselves. I find it difficult and distasteful to believe that anyone could have succeeded in meddling with our minds. A few of us I could understand, but our entire race? No, it cannot be.
Why would you, the Weercats, have been entrusted with this information?
Because, I would guess, we have always been friends of the Riders and friends of the Dragons. We are the Watchers, the Listeners, the Wanderers. We walk alone in the dark places of the world, and we remember what it is and what has been.
Solombum's gaze shifted away.
Understand this, Eragon. None of us have been happy with the situation. We long debated whether it would cause more harm than good to pass on this information should the moment arise. In the end, the decision was mine, and I decided to tell you, for it seemed you needed all the help you could get. Make of it what you will.
But what am I supposed to do? Said Eragon. How am I supposed to find the Rock of Cuthien?
That I cannot say.
Then what use is the information? I might as well have never heard it. Solombum blinked once.
There is one other thing I can tell you. It may mean nothing, but perhaps it can show you the way.
What? What is it?
If you but wait, I will tell you. When I first met you in Tiam, I had a strange feeling that you ought to have the book Domia Aberwyrda. It took me time to arrange it, but it was I who was responsible for Jode giving the book to you.
Then the Weercat lifted his other paw, and after a cursory examination, began to lick it. "Have you gotten any other strange feelings in the past few months?" asked Eragon.
"Only the urge to eat a small red mushroom, but it passed quickly enough."
Eragon grunted and bent down to retrieve the book from under his cot, where he kept it with the rest of his writing supplies. He stared at the large leather-bound volume before opening it to a random page. As usual, the thicket of runes within made little sense to him at first glance. It was only with a concerted effort that he was able to decipher even a few of them. Which, if Talodorus is to be believed, would mean that the mountains themselves were the result of a spell. That, of course, is absurd, for... Eragon growled with frustration and closed the book. I don't have time for this. It's too big and I'm too slow of a reader. I've already gone through a fair number of chapters, and I've seen nothing having to do with the Rock of Cuthien or the Vault of Souls. Solombum eyed him for a moment.
You could ask someone else to read it for you. But if there is a secret hidden in Domia Aberwyrda, you may be the only one who can see it.
Eragon resisted the desire to curse. Springing up from the stool, he began to pace again.
Why didn't you tell me about all this sooner?
It didn't seem important. Either my advice concerning the vault and the rock would be of help, or it wouldn't. And knowing the origins of that information, or lack thereof, would have changed nothing.
But if I had known it had something to do with the Vault of Souls, I would have spent more time reading it.
But we don't know that it does,
said Solombum. His tongue slipped out of his mouth and passed over the whiskers on each side of his face, smoothing them.
The book may have nothing to do with the Rock of Cuthien or the Vault of Souls. Who can say? Besides, you were already reading it. Would you really have spent more time with it if I had said that I had a feeling, and mind you, nothing more? That the book was of some significance to you? Hmm?
Maybe not, but you still should have told me. The Weercat tucked his front paws under his breast and did not answer. Eragon scowled, gripping the book and feeling as if he wanted to tear it apart. This can't be everything. There has to be some other piece of information that you've forgotten.
Many, but none, I think, related to this.
In all your travels around Alagaesia, with Angela and without, you've never found anything that might explain this mystery? Or even just something that might be of use against Galbatorix?
I found you, didn't I?
That's not funny, growled Aragorn. Blast it, you have to know something more.
I do not.
Think, then. If I can't find some sort of help against Galbatorix, we'll lose, Solemnbum. We'll lose. And most of the Varden, including the Weircats, will die. Solemnbum hissed again.
What do you expect of me, Aragorn? I cannot invent help where none exists. Read the book.
We'll be at Urabain before I can finish it. The book might as well not exist. Solemnbum's ears flattened again.
That is not my fault.
I don't care if it is. I just want a way to keep us from ending up dead or enslaved. Think, you have to know something else. Solemnbum uttered a low, warbling growl.
I do not. And?
You have to, or we're doomed. Even as Aragorn uttered the words, he saw a change come over the Weircat. Solemnbum's ears swiveled until they were upright, his whiskers relaxed, and his gaze softened, losing its hard-edged brilliance. At the same time, the Weircat's mind grew unusually empty, as if his consciousness had been stilled or removed. Aragorn froze, uncertain. Then he felt Solemnbum say, with thoughts that were as flat and colourless as a pool of water beneath a wintry, cloud-ridden sky.
Chapter 47, page 3. Start with the second passage thereon.
Solemnbum's gaze sharpened, and his ears returned to their previous position.
What?
He said with obvious irritation.
Why are you gaping at me like that?
What did you just say?
I said that I do not know anything else, and that—
No, the other thing. About the chapter and page.
Do not toy with me. I said no such thing.
You did. Solemnbum studied him for several seconds. Then with thoughts that were overly calm, he said,
Tell me exactly what you heard, Dragon Rider.
So Aragorn repeated the words as closely as he could. When he had finished, the Weircat was silent for a while.
I have no memory of that,
he said. What do you think it means?
It means that we should look and see what's on page 3 of chapter 47.
Aragorn hesitated, then nodded, and began to flip through the pages. As he did, he remembered the chapter in question. It was the one devoted to the aftermath of the Riders' secession from the Elves, following the Elves' brief war with the humans. Aragorn had read the beginning of the section, but it had seemed to be nothing more than a dry discussion of treaties and negotiations, so he had left it for another time. Soon enough, he arrived at the proper page. Tracing the lines of the runes with the tip of his finger, Aragorn slowly read out loud, The island is remarkably temperate, compared with areas of the mainland at the same latitude. Summers are often cool and rainy, but then the winters are mild, and tend not to assume the brutal cold of the northern reaches of the spine, which means that crops could be grown for a goodly portion of the year. By all accounts, the soil is rich and fertile. The one benefit of the fire mountains that are known to erupt from time to time and cover the island with a thick layer of ash, and the forests were full of large game, such as the dragons preferred to hunt, including many species not found elsewhere in Alagaesia. Aragorn paused. None of this seems relevant.
Keep reading.
Frowning, Aragorn continued on to the next paragraph. It was there, in the great cauldron at the center of Vroengard, that the Riders built their far-famed city, Doru Areba. Doru Areba, the only city in history designed to house dragons
as well as elves and humans. Doru Areba, a place of magic and learning and ancient mysteries. Doru Areba, the very name seems to hum with excitement. Never was there a city like it before, and never shall there be again, for now it is lost, destroyed, ground to dust by the usurper Galbatorix. The buildings were constructed in the elvish style, with some influence from human writers in later years, but out of stone, not wood. Wooden buildings, as must be obvious to the reader, fare poorly around creatures with razor-sharp claws and the ability to breathe fire. The most notable feature of Doru Areba, however, was its enormous scale. Every street was wide enough for at least two dragons to walk abreast, and with few exceptions, rooms and doorways were large enough to accommodate dragons of most any size. As a result, Doru Areba was a vast, sprawling affair, dotted with buildings of such immense proportions, even a dwarf would have been impressed. Gardens and fountains were common throughout the city, on account of the elves' irrepressible love of nature, and there were many soaring towers among the riders' halls and holds. Upon the peaks surrounding the city, the riders placed watchtowers and aeries to guard against attack, and more than one dragon and rider had a well-appointed cave high in the mountains, where they lived apart from the rest of their order. The older, larger dragons were especially partial to this arrangement, as they often preferred solitude, and living above the floor of the cauldron made it easier for them to take flight. Frustrated, Aragorn broke off. The description of Doru Areba was interesting enough, but he had read other more detailed accounts of the Rider's City during his time in Ellesmere. Nor did he enjoy having to decipher the cramped runes, a painstaking process even at the best of times. "This is pointless," he said, lowering the book. Solombum looked as annoyed as Aragorn felt.
"Don't give up yet. Read another two pages. If there's nothing by then you can stop."
Aragorn took a breath and agreed. He ran his finger down the page until he found his place, whereupon he began again to pick out the sounds of the words. The city contained many marvels, from the singing fountain of Eldamirim to the crystal fortress of Sveljahol to the rookeries of the dragons themselves. But for all their splendor, I believe that Doru Areba's greatest treasure was its library, not, as one might assume, because of its imposing structure, although it was indeed imposing, but because over the centuries the riders collected one of the most comprehensive stores of knowledge in the whole of the land. By the time of the riders' fall, there were only three libraries that rivaled it, that of Illyria, that of Ellesmere, and that of Trondheim. And none of those three contained as much information about the workings of magic as did the one in Doru Areba. The library was located on the northwestern edge of the city, near the gardens that surrounded Moretus Spire, also known as the Rock of Cuthien. Aragorn's voice died in his throat as he stared at the name. After a moment, he began again, even slower. "Also known as the Rock of Cuthien, see chapter 12, and not far from the high seat, where the leaders of the riders held court, when various kings and queens came to petition them." A sense of awe and fear came over Aragorn. Some person or something had arranged for him to learn this particular piece of information, the same person or thing that had made it possible for him to find the bright steel for his sword. The thought was intimidating. and now that Aragorn knew where to go, he was no longer quite so sure that he wanted to. What, he wondered, lay waiting for them on Vroengard? He was afraid to speculate, lest he raise hopes that were impossible to fulfill. Questions Unanswered. Aragorn searched through Dormir Abur Wirda until he found the reference to Cuthien in the 12th chapter. To his disappointment, all it said was that Cuthien had been one of the first riders to explore Vroengard Island. Afterward, he closed the book and sat staring at it, thumbing a ridge embossed across the spine. On the cot, Solemnbum was silent as well.
"Do you think that the Vault of Souls contains spirits?" asked Aragorn.
"Spirits are not the souls of the dead."
"No, but what else could they be?"
Solemnbum rose from where he had been sitting and stretched, a wave of motion moving through his body from his head to his tail.
"If you find out, I would be interested to hear what you discover."
"Do you think Saphira and I should go then?"
"I cannot tell you what you should do. If this is a trap, then most of my race has been broken and enslaved without them realizing it, and the Varden might as well surrender now, because they will never outwit Galbatorix. If not, then this may be an opportunity to find assistance where we thought none was to be had. I cannot say. You have to decide on your own whether it is a chance worth taking. As for me, I have had enough of this mystery."
He jumped down from the cot and walked over to the opening of the tent, where he paused and glanced back at Aragorn.
"There are many strange forces at work in Alagaesia, Shadeslayer. I have seen things that defy belief. Whirlwinds of light spinning in caverns deep below the ground. Men who age backward, stones that speak, and shadows that creep. Rooms that are bigger on the inside than the outside. Galbatorix is not the only power in the world to be reckoned with, and he may not even be the strongest. Choose carefully, Shadeslayer, and if you choose to go, walk softly."
And then the Weircat slipped out of the tent and vanished into the darkness. Aragorn released his breath and leaned back. He knew what he had to do. He had to go to Vroengard, but he could not make that decision without consulting Saphira. With a gentle nudge of his mind, he woke her, and once he had assured her that nothing was amiss, he shared his memories of Solemnbum's visit. Her astonishment was as great as his. When he finished, she said,
"I do not like the thought of playing the puppet to whoever has enchanted the Weircats."
"Neither do I. But what other choice do we have? If Galbatorix is behind this, then we'll be placing ourselves in his hands. But if we stay, then we'll be doing exactly the same, only when we arrive at Urubane."
"The difference is, we would have the Varden and the elves with us."
"That's true."
Silence fell between them for a time. Then Saphira said,
"I agree. I agree. We should go. We need longer claws and sharper teeth if we are to best Galbatorix and Shrukan in addition to Murtag and Thorn. Besides, Galbatorix expects us to rush straight to Urubane in hope of rescuing Nasawada. And if there is one thing that makes my scales itch, it is doing what our enemies expect."
Aragorn nodded.
"And if this is a trap?"
A soft growl sounded outside the tent.
"Then we will teach whoever set it to fear our names, even if it is Galbatorix."
He smiled. For the first time since Nasawada's abduction, He felt a sense of purposeful direction. Here was something they could do, a means by which they could influence the unfolding of events, instead of just sitting by as passive observers. "Right then," he muttered. Arya arrived at his tent mere seconds after he contacted her. Her speed puzzled him until she explained that she had been keeping watch with Blodgarm and the other elves, lest Murtagh and Thorn return. With her there, Aragorn reached out with his mind to Gleyda and coaxed him into joining their conversation, though the surly dragon was in no mood to talk. Once the four of them, including Zephira, were all joined by their thoughts, Aragorn finally burst out, "I know where the Rock of Cuthien is!"
"What rock is this?"
Gleyda rumbled, his tone sour.
"The name seems familiar," said Arya, "but I cannot place it."
Aragorn frowned slightly. Both of them had heard him speak of Solombum's advice before. It was not like either of them to forget. Nevertheless, Aragorn repeated the story of his encounter with Solombum in Tirm, and then he told them about the Weircat's most recent revelations, and read them the pertinent section from the book Domia Aberwyrda. Arya tucked a strand of hair behind one of her pointed ears. Speaking both with her mind and her voice, she said,
"And what is the name of this place again?"
"Moraetus Spire, or the Rock of Cuthien," replied Aragorn in the same manner. He hesitated for half a second, briefly thrown by her question. "It's a long flight, but..."
"If Aragorn and I leave forthwith," said Zephira,
"we can travel there and back.
Before the Varden arrive at Urabain, this is our only chance to go. We'll not have the time to make the trip later on." "Where would you be flying to, though?"
asked Gleyda.
"What? What do you mean?"
"Exactly what I said,"
the dragon growled, the field of his mind darkening.
"For all your yammering, you've yet to tell us where this mysterious thing is located."
"I have, though," said Aragorn, bewildered. "It's on Rowengard Island."
"At last, a straightforward answer."
A frown creased Arya's brow.
"But what would you do on Rowengard?"
"I don't know," said Aragorn, his temper rising. He debated whether it was worth confronting Gleyda about his remarks. The dragon seemed to be needling Aragorn on purpose. "It depends on what we find. Once we're there, we'll try to open the Rock of Cuthien and discover whatever secrets it contains. If it's a trap," he shrugged, "then we'll fight." Arya's expression grew increasingly troubled.
"The Rock of Cuthien. The name seems weighted with significance, but I cannot say why. It echoes in my mind, like a song I once knew, but have since forgotten."
She shook her head and put her hands to her temples.
"Ah, now it is gone."
She looked up.
"Forgive me. What were we speaking of?"
"Going to Rowengard," Aragorn said slowly.
"Ah, yes. But for what purpose? You're needed here, Aragorn. In any case, nothing of value remains on Rowengard."
"Aye,"
said Gleyda.
"It is a dead and abandoned place. After the destruction of Doru Areba, the few of us who had escaped returned to search for anything that might be of use. But the Forsworn had already picked the ruins clean."
Arya nodded.
"Whatever put this idea in your head in the first place? I don't understand how you could believe deserting the Varden now, when they're at their most vulnerable, could possibly be wise. And for what? To fly to the far ends of Alagazia without cause or reason? I had thought better of you. You cannot leave just because you are uncomfortable with your new station, Aragorn."
Aragorn decoupled his mind from Arya and Gleyda, and signalled to Zephira to do the same.
"They don't remember. They can't remember."
"It is magic, deep magic,
like the spell that hides the names of the dragons who betrayed the riders.
But you haven't forgotten about the Rock of Kuthian, have you?
Of course not,
she said, her mind flashing green with pique.
How could I, when we are so closely joined?
A sense of vertigo gripped Aragorn as he considered the implications. In order to be effective, the spell would have to erase the memories of everyone who knew about the rock in the first place, and also the memories of anyone who heard or read about it thereafter. Which means the whole of Alagaesia is in the thrall of this enchantment. No one can escape its reach.
Except for us.
Except for us, he agreed. And the Weircats.
And perhaps Galbatorix.
Aragorn shivered. It felt as if spiders made of ice crystals were crawling up and down his spine. The size of the deception astounded him and left him feeling small, vulnerable. To cloud the minds of elves, dwarves, humans, and dragons alike, and without arousing the slightest hint of suspicion, was a feat so difficult he doubted it could have been accomplished by a deliberate application of craft. Rather, he believed it could only have been done by instinct, for such a spell would be far too complicated to put into words. He had to know who was responsible for manipulating the minds of everyone in Alagaesia, and why. If it was Galbatorix, then Aragorn feared that Solombum was right, and the Vardan's defeat was inevitable. "Do you think this was the work of dragons, as was the banishing of the names?" he asked. Sephira was slow to answer.
"Perhaps. But then, as Solombum said to you, there are many powers in Alagaesia. Until we go to Vroengard, we won't know for certain one way or another."
"If ever we do..."
"Aye."
Aragorn ran his fingers through his hair. He suddenly felt exceptionally tired. "Why does everything have to be so hard?" he wondered.
"Because," said Sephira, "everyone wants to eat, but no one wants to be eaten."
He snorted, grimly amused. Despite the speed with which he and Sephira could exchange thoughts, their conversation had lasted long enough for Arya and Gleda to notice. "Why have you closed your minds to us?" asked Arya. Her gaze flicked toward one wall of the tent, the wall nearest to where Sephira lay curled in the darkness beyond. "Is something wrong?"
"You seem perturbed,"
Gleda added. Aragorn stifled a humorless chuckle. "Perhaps because I am." Arya watched with concern as he went over to the cot and sat on the edge. He let his arms hang limp and heavy between his legs. He was silent for a moment, as he made the shift from the language of his birth to that of the elves and magic, whereupon he said, "Do you trust Sephira and me?" The resulting pause was gratifyingly brief. "I do," replied Arya, also in the ancient language.
"As do I,"
Gleda likewise said. "Shall I, or shall you?" Aragorn quickly asked Sephira.
"You want to tell them, so tell them."
Aragorn looked up at Arya. Then, still in the ancient language, he said to both her and Gleda, "Solombum has told me the name of a place on Vroengard, where Sephira and I may find someone or something to help us defeat Galbatorix. However, the name is enchanted. Every time I say the name, you soon forget it." A faint expression of shock appeared on Arya's face. "Do you believe me?"
"I believe you,"
Arya slowly said.
"I believe that you believe what you are saying,"
Gleda growled.
"But that does not necessarily make it so."
"How else can I prove it? You won't remember if I tell you the name or share my memories with you. You could question Solombum, but again, what good would it do?"
"What good? For one, we can prove that you haven't been tricked or deceived by something that only appeared to be Solemnbum. And as for the spell, there may be a way to demonstrate its existence. Summon the Weirkat, and then we shall see what can be done.
Will you? Aragorn asked Saphira. He thought that the Weirkat would be more likely to come if Saphira asked him. A moment later, he felt her searching with her mind through the camp, and then he sensed the touch of Solemnbum's consciousness against Saphira's. After she and the Weirkat exchanged a brief, wordless communication, Saphira announced,
"He is on his way."
They waited in silence, Aragorn staring down at his hands as he compiled a list of supplies he would need for the trip to Vroengard. When Solemnbum pushed aside the flaps to the tent and entered, Aragorn was surprised to see that he was now in his human form, that of a young boy, dark-eyed and insolent. In his left hand, the Weirkat held a leg of roast goose on which he was gnawing. A ring of grease coated his lips and chin, and drops of melted fat had splattered his bare chest. As he chewed on a strip of flesh, Solemnbum motioned with his sharp, pointed chin toward the patch of dirt where Gleyder's Heart of Hearts lay buried.
"What is it you want, Fire Breather?" he asked.
"To know if you are who you seem to be," said Gleyder,
and the dragon's consciousness seemed to surround Solemnbum's, pressing inward like piles of black clouds around a brightly burning but wind-battered flame. The dragon's strength was immense, and from personal experience, Aragorn knew that few could hope to withstand him. With a gargled yowl, Solemnbum spat out his mouthful of meat and sprang backward, as if he had stepped on a viper. He stood where he was then, trembling with effort, his sharp teeth bared, and a look of such fury in his tawny eyes, Aragorn placed his hand on the hilt of Brisinger as a precaution. The flame dimmed, but held, a white-hot point of light amid a sea of churning thunderheads. After a minute, the storm diminished and the clouds withdrew, although they did not disappear entirely.
"My apologies, Weirkat," said Gleyder, "but I had to know for certain."
Solemnbum hissed, and the hair on his head fluffed and spiked so that it resembled the blossom of a thistle.
"If you still had your body, old one, I would cut off your tail for that."
"You little cat, you could not have done more than scratch me."
Again Solemnbum hissed, and then he turned on his heel and stalked toward the entrance, his shoulders hunched close to his ears.
"Wait,"
said Gleyder.
"Did you tell Aragorn about this place on Vroengard? This place of secrets that none can remember?"
The Weirkat paused, and without turning around, he growled and brandished the goose leg over his head in an impatient, dismissive gesture.
"I did."
"And did you tell him the page in Domir Aber Weirda wherein he found the location of this place?"
"So it seems, but I have no memory of it, and I hope that whatever is on Vroengard singes your whiskers and burns your paws."
The entrance to the tent made a loud flapping sound as Solemnbum swatted it aside. Then his small form melted into the shadows as if he had never existed. Aragorn stood, and with the toe of his boot pushed the scrap of half-eaten meat out of the tent.
"You should not have been so rough with him," said Arya.
"I had no other choice,"
said Gleyder.
"Didn't you? You could have asked his permission first."
"And given him the opportunity to prepare? No, it is done. Let it be, Arya."
"I cannot. His pride is wounded. You should attempt to placate him. It would be dangerous to have a Weirkat as your enemy."
"It is even more dangerous to have a dragon as your enemy. Let it be, Elfling."
Troubled, Aragorn exchanged looks with Arya. Gleyder's tone bothered him, and her as well, he could see. But Aragorn could not decide what to do about it.
"Now, Aragorn,"
the golden dragon said,
"will you allow me to examine the memories of your conversation with Solemnbum?"
If you want, but why? You'll only end up forgetting.
Perhaps. And then again, perhaps not. We shall see.
Addressing Arya, Gleda said,
Separate your mind from ours, and do not allow Aragorn's memories to taint your consciousness.
As you wish, Gleda Elder. As Arya spoke, the music of her thoughts grew ever more distant. A moment later, the eerie singing faded to silence. Then Gleda returned his attention to Aragorn.
Show me,
he commanded. Ignoring his trepidation, Aragorn cast his mind back to when Solombum had first arrived at the tent, and he carefully recalled everything that had transpired between the two of them thereafter. Gleda's consciousness melded with Aragorn's, so that the dragon could relive the experiences along with him. It was an unsettling sensation. It felt as if he and the dragon were two images stamped onto the same side of a coin. When he finished, Gleda withdrew somewhat from Aragorn's mind, and then to Arya said,
When I have forgotten, if I do, repeat to me the words Andume and Firenmas at the Hill of Sorrows, and their flesh like glass. This place on Vloengard, I know of it, or I once did. It was something of importance, something...
The dragon's thoughts grayed for a second, as if a layer of mist had been blown over the hills and valleys of his being, obscuring them.
Well?
He demanded, regaining his former brusque attitude.
Why do we tarry? Aragorn, show me your memories.
I already have. Even as Gleda's mood turned to disbelief, Arya said,
Gleda, remember Andume and Firenmas at the Hill of Sorrows, and their flesh like glass.
How?
Gleda started, and then he growled with such force Aragorn almost expected to hear the sound out loud.
Bah! I hate spells that interfere with one's memory. They're the worst form of magic, always leading to chaos and confusion. Half the time they seem to end with family members killing one another without realizing it.
What does the phrase you use mean?
Saphira asked.
Nothing, except to me and Oromis. But that was the point. No one would know of it unless I told them.
Arya sighed.
So the spell is real. I suppose you have to go to Vroengard then. To ignore something of this importance would be folly. If nothing else, we need to know who the spider is at the center of this web.
I shall go as well,
said Gleda.
If someone means to harm you, they may not expect to fight two dragons instead of one. In any event, you will need a guide. Vroengard has become a dangerous place since the destruction of the Riders, and I would not have you fall prey to some forgotten evil.
Aragorn hesitated as he noticed a strange yearning in Arya's gaze, and he realized that she wanted to accompany them as well.
Saphira will fly faster if she only has to carry one person, he said in a quiet voice. I know. Only, I always wanted to visit the home of the Riders.
I'm sure you will, someday. She nodded.
Someday.
Aragorn took a moment to marshal his energy and reflect on everything that needed to be done before he, Saphira, and Gleda could leave. Then he drew a deep breath and rose from the cot. Captain Garvin, he called. Will you please join us? Departure. First, Aragorn had Garvin, with all secrecy, send one of the Nighthawks to collect provisions for the trip to Vroengard. Saphira had eaten after the capture of Dras Leona, but she had not gorged herself, else she would have been too slow and too heavy to fight if the need arose, as indeed it had. She was well enough fed then to fly to Vroengard without stopping, but once there, Aragorn knew she would have to find food on or around the island, which worried him.
I can always fly back on an empty stomach,
she assured him, but he was not so certain.
Next, Aragorn sent a runner to bring Jormungandr and Blodgarm to his tent. Once they arrived, it took Aragorn, Arya and Saphira another hour to explain the situation to them, and harder still, to convince them that the trip was necessary. Blodgarm was the easiest to win over to their point of view, whereas Jormungandr objected vociferously, not because he doubted the veracity of the information from Solombam, nor even because he doubted its importance. On both those points, he accepted Aragorn's word without question. But, as he argued with increasing vehemence, because it would destroy the Varden if they woke to find not only that Nasawada had been kidnapped, but that Aragorn and Saphira had vanished to parts unknown.
"Furthermore, we don't dare let Galbatorix think that you've left us," Jormungandr said. "Not when we're so close to Urabane. He might send Murtagh and Thorn to intercept you, or he might take the opportunity to crush the Varden once and for all. We can't risk it."
His concerns, Aragorn was forced to acknowledge, were valid. After much discussion, they finally arrived at a solution. Blodgarm and the other elves would create apparitions of both Aragorn and Saphira, even as they had created one of Aragorn when he had gone to the Beor Mountains to participate in the election and coronation of Hrothgar's successor. The images would appear to be perfect, living, breathing, thinking replicas of Aragorn and Saphira, but their minds would be empty, and if anyone peered into them, the ruse would be discovered. As a result, the image of Saphira would be unable to speak, and although the elves could feign speech on the part of Aragorn, that too would be better to avoid, lest some oddity of diction alert those listening that all was not as it seemed. The limitations of the illusions meant that they would work best at a distance, and that the people who had reason to interact with Aragorn and Saphira on a more personal basis, such as the kings Orin and Oric, would soon realize that something was amiss. So Aragorn ordered Garvin to wake all the Nighthawks and bring them to him as discreetly as possible. When the whole company was gathered before his tent, Aragorn explained to the motley group of men, dwarves and Urgles why he and Saphira were leaving, although he was purposefully vague about the details, and he kept their destination a secret. Then he explained how the elves were going to conceal their absence, and he had the men swear oaths of secrecy in the ancient language. He trusted them, but one could never be too careful where Galbatorix and his spies were concerned. Afterward, Aragorn and Arya visited Orin, Oric, Rohan, and the sorceress Triana. As with the Nighthawks, they explained the situation, and from each of them extracted oaths of secrecy. King Orin, as Aragorn expected, proved to be the most intransigent. He expressed outrage at the prospect of either Aragorn or Saphira travelling to Vroengard, and railed at length against the idea. He questioned Aragorn's bravery, questioned the value of Solombum's information, and threatened to withdraw his forces from the Varden if Aragorn continued to pursue such a foolish, misguided course. It took over an hour of threats, flattery, and coaxing to bring him around. And even then, Aragorn feared Orin might go back on his word. The visits to Oric, Rohan, and Triana went faster, but Aragorn and Arya still had to spend what seemed to Aragorn an unreasonable amount of time talking with them. Impatience made him curt and restless. He wanted to be off, and every minute that passed only increased his sense of urgency. As he and Arya went from person to person, Aragorn was also aware, through his link with Saphira, of the elves' faint, lilting chanting, which underlay everything he heard, like a strip of cunningly woven fabric hidden beneath the surface of the world. Saphira had remained at his tent, and the elves were ringed about her, their arms outstretched and the tips of their fingers touching while they sang. The purpose of their long, complicated spell was to collect the visual information they would need in order to create an accurate representation of Saphira. It was difficult enough to imitate the shape of an elf or a human. A dragon was harder still, especially given the refractive nature of her scales. Even so, the most complicated part of the illusion, as Blodgarm had told Aragorn, would be reproducing the effects of Saphira's weight on her surroundings every time her apparition took off or landed. When, at last, Aragorn and Arya had finished making their rounds, night had already given way to day, and the morning sun hung a hand's breadth above the horizon. By its light, the damage wrought upon the camp during the attack
seemed even greater. Aragorn would have been happy to depart with Saphira and Gleda then, but Jormungandr insisted that he address the Varden at least once, properly, as their new leader. Therefore, soon afterward, once the army was assembled, Aragorn found himself standing in the back of an empty wagon, looking out over a field of upturned faces, some human and some not, and wishing he were anywhere but there. Aragorn had asked Rohan for advice beforehand, and Rohan had told him, "Remember, they're not your enemies. You have nothing to fear from them. They want to like you. Speak clearly, speak honestly, and whatever you do, keep your doubts to yourself. That's the way to win them over. They're going to be frightened and dismayed once you tell them about Nasawada. Give them the reassurance they need, and they'll follow you through the very gates of Urubane." Despite Rohan's encouragement, Aragorn still felt apprehensive before his speech. He had rarely spoken to large groups before, and never for more than a few lines. As he gazed at the sun-darkened, battle-worn warriors before him, he decided that he would rather fight 100 enemies by himself than have to stand up in public and risk the disapproval of others. Until the moment he opened his mouth, Aragorn was not sure what he was going to say. Once he started, the words seemed to pour out of their own accord, but he was so tense he could not remember much of what he said. The speech passed in a blur. His main impressions were of heat and sweat, the groans of the warriors when they learned of Nasawada's fate, the ragged cheers when he exhorted them to victory, and the general roar from the crowd when he finished. With relief, he jumped down from the back of the wagon to where Arya and Oryk were waiting next to Saphira. As he did, his guards formed a circle around the four of them, shielding them from the crowd and holding back those who wished to speak with him.
"Well done, Aragorn," said Oryk, clapping him on the arm.
"Was it?" Aragorn asked, feeling dazed.
"You were most eloquent," said Arya.
Aragorn shrugged, embarrassed. It intimidated him to remember that Arya had known most of the leaders of the Varden, and he could not help but think that Arjahad, or his predecessor Daenor, would have done a better job with the speech. Oryk pulled on his sleeve. Aragorn bent toward the dwarf. In a voice barely loud enough to be heard over the crowd, Oryk said,
"I hope that whatever you find is worth the trip, my friend. Take care you don't get yourselves killed, eh?"
"I'll try not to." To Aragorn's surprise, Oryk grabbed him by the forearm and pulled him into a rough embrace.
"May Gunterra watch over you."
As they separated, Oryk reached over and slapped the palm of his hand against Saphira's side.
"And you as well, Saphira. Safe journeys to the both of you."
Saphira responded with a low hum. Aragorn looked over at Arya. He suddenly felt awkward, unable to think of anything but the most obvious things to say. The beauty of her eyes still captivated him. The effect she had on him never seemed to lessen. Then she took his head in her hands, and she kissed him once, formally, on the brow. Aragorn stared at her, dumbstruck.
"Gulie weiza medono, Arjatlam."
"Luck be with you, Silverhand." As she released him, he caught her hands in his own. "Nothing bad is going to happen to us. I won't let it. Not even if Galbatorix is waiting for us. If I have to, I'll tear apart mountains with my bare hands. But I promise we're going to make it back safely." Before she could respond, he let go of her hands and climbed onto Saphira's back. The crowd began to cheer again as they saw him settle into the saddle. He waved to them, and they redoubled their efforts, stamping their feet and pounding their shields with the pommels of their swords. Aragorn saw Blodgarm and the other elves gathered in a close-knit group, half-hidden behind a nearby pavilion. He nodded to them, and they nodded in return. The plan was simple. He and Saphira would set off as if they intended to patrol the skies and scout the land ahead, as they normally did when the army was on the march. But after circling the camp a few times, Saphira would fly into a cloud, and Aragorn would cast a spell that would render her invisible to those watching from below. Then the elves would create the hollow wraiths that would take Aragorn and Saphira's place, while they continued on with their journey, and it would be the wraiths that onlookers would see emerge from the cloud.
Hopefully, none would notice the difference. With